Mr. Bell, reel 6. So after you've done these working up exercises, roughly September 43, what's the next thing you recall?
Well, we were assigned to the 3rd Escort Group. The 3rd Escort Group, that was the our flag. It was the 3rd flag, you know, the checkered flag. And that was pinned on the phone. And we were assigned to the 3rd Escort Group operating from Belfast. And that was 6 of us in that group.
And was that based at Pollock Dock, Belfast?
Pollock Dock, Belfast, yes.
So alongside the 4th escort group, who'd be there,
yes,
as well.
Right.
And yes. When did you arrive?
I would be there, yes. I would be there.
And when would you arrive there? Do you any idea?
We came straight across the Atlantic and we were assigned there. So that was the journey across the Atlantic.
Do you remember much about the Atlantic crossing?
No, I don't remember that, you see. I don't remember whether we escorted the convoy or not. I suppose we did.
Now, one thing about the captain class was the rolling. Did you become aware of that? I mean, what did you think of the rolling on
She could roll, yes. She rolled, absolutely. She rolled very much. She did roll. And pitched, of course. You're pitching and you're rolling. I'm off. But she was a pretty good seaboat, really. She was a pretty good seaboat. I was very critical of the Yankee welding, you know, and very critical of the Yankee construction, but I changed my mind. It was very, very good. The Yankee did a very good job of building.
So she was a dry ship?
She really was, yes, she really was.
You didn't have any water leaking in that
No, she was very, very a good ship that way, yes. In fact, I have fond memories of the Dummett. She was very, very good.
Now, what about the refitting? I believe they were all refitted to English standards when they got to Belfast. Do you recall what happened with the refitting?
Well, I don't really, because I don't think we did much refitting here. Did much actual changing, you know, and we operated as a Yankee destroyer would do, you know. We did very well. I think the earlier ones did. We were later, but the earlier ones, I think that Harry Fine was on. I think they were refitted a lot.
So you didn't lose your water fountain, or you didn't get changed from cafeteria?
Well, yes, we lost those. We kept our cafeteria, but we lost the water fountains. They were ammunition lockers.
And I thought they introduced, they put loads more depth charge storage and things like that.
Yes, they did. We had two depth charge racks on the stern, and they were very efficient. And they were loaded right up. We had 20 or 30 depth charges, you know. And that was a lot for those ships to carry. And of course, that was the bounce as well, you know. That was the pitching and rolling. But they handled very well. And the depth charge crews were trained in Bermuda to do all this, you see. I thought we fitted in very well. We acted like a British destroyer group would do, you know. We were best the same way. And Duckworth was our leader. Duckworth was our leading vessel.
And what do you remember of your first convoy? I think your first convoy was a convoy to Gibraltar in early December. Do you remember that at all?
Oh, my goodness. I remember so much.
What do you remember of that?
It was a convoy. The book tells you, actually, but I'll tell you what it was. We were assigned to convoy. The 3rd Escort Group were designed to convoy some heavy units, you know. The Unicorn, the carrier, was one, and the renowned sister ship, it was another one, and it was heavy units, you know, same heavy battle units that were being assigned to Port Said and to go out to the Far East. And we were assigned from Scapa Flow to escort these ships down to Gibraltar. And my God, these heavy units, of course, were fast, you know. They were far, far too fast. I mean, were doing 19 knots down there through the Minches, you know, between the inner and outer Hebrides. And that, Peter, that's the roughest man I've ever encountered.
This was actually the second convoy, when you convoyed the capital ships to port side in January 44. What was the bad weather like?
It was absolutely horrendous, Peter. I'll tell you one incident I remember when I was there. I was on deck, and the weather was absolutely horrendous, you know. In fact, I shouldn't have been on deck at that time. We had a strap, you know, a line along the deck. And we all had a harness, and we were strapped on this harness, which ran along the wire, in case we went over the side, you see. And I remember that there was one time there was a big tug nearly alongside us, and the next thing I saw, the tug was up there, up here. And as we went slid underneath like that, the tug went away and slid down the other side. So we nearly collided, you know. I thought that was pretty horrendous. And the weather was just uncontrollable. And I remember our group leader signaled over to the battleship where the admiral was on. Permission to use speed, please, you know. We're having a difficulty with the destroyer escort, you know, can't keep this up. He said, you're in the British Navy now, carry on, you know. In other words, you maintain speed, because he explained to them that he maintained speed to escape the U-boats, you see. But the weather was horrendous. I think it's just about the worst I've ever been in, that weather. I've been in some awful weather, but that one was really ferocious, you know. And it was, and we escorted them to Portishead, and we got to them in Portishead. We went through the Med, and we got to Portishead, and we left them there for somebody else to take over. I think Fleet Destroyers took them out to the Far East from then on. And we were relieved of that duty. Right?
Now, you seem to have been operating in the Atlantic on occasions in sort of early 44. What do you remember of that? Were you with Convoy, so you were sweeping?
We were sweeping altogether. We were with convoys, but we were doing our sweeps, you see. That was part of your duties, you know. And we were... The Domit was commanded by Lieutenant Commander... Sterling Gordon.
What did you think of him?
Oh, he was a smashing man. He had a beard. And one day he came down without his beard, he shaved it off. He lost all respect. the beard made him, you know. But he was a nice man. I was, they knew I failed seemingly, you know. And they sort of took to me, you know, and asked me, and I was his secretary for a while, you know. I used to do secretary work for a while.
What did that involve?
Well, you know, doing all the various logs and things like that he had to do. You know, secretary work was to generally look after him, you know. Any pen pushing I had to do, you know. Because I'd been a pen pusher, so that was, something to do. I used to look after him, you know. That was his... And I had access to his cabin, you know, when I felt like it, you know. But not to just go in when I felt like it, you know. But he was a smashing bloke. He was really good. He was one of the Gordons from Stirling. That's how he got his name, Stirling Gordon. Stirling-hyphenated Gordon. And after the war, after I left the Domit, he wanted me to go and be his man, you know, up in his country. Estate. I said, no, I've had enough of you. That's it. He took him good time.
Do you remember any incidents during the period of operating in the Atlantic?
Yes, I can. I can remember one thing when we encountered the U-boat, and I was killing this U-boat. I had this in my sight, you know.
Tell me as much as you can remember about that.
I will. He was on a bridge, and a duty officer was there as well. I forget who it was. But he was on the bridge because... we had this U-boat and we were about to destroy it, you know. And Duckett took over from us, actually. She wanted the glory, you know, and she took over from us. But I remember this hour, my account was that I had this in my sights like this. And I was reporting to the skipper all the time, you know, the U-boat's diving, he's coming up, he's going right, he's going left, he's doing all the various things that you need to know as an Atlantic reading. And I was recording all this stuff, and I said, "Well done, Bell," he said, "well done," he said. And I said, "There's one thing you haven't told me." I said, "What's that?" He said, "What's the young boy, Captain Thingy?" "Oh," I said, "that's the one thing I can't do," he said. I said, "That's your job, sir." He said, "Of course it is," he said. We said, "I need some help." You know, he was very, that was the third book he was. Now, that was rather nice, wasn't it? That camaraderie, you know. And the lieutenant master sent me out afterwards, because he had to work within the ship's office, you know, in harbour. And master said, "You know, that was very good, George," he said, "you know, that you kept him going and he appreciated it, you know."
Who was that? That's another officer. Let's go through a couple more officers. What was sub-lieutenant Marsh?
Sub-lieutenant Marsh, yes.
What was it? Do you know his first name? No.
Yes, word it now. I'm not a fish. I'm in memory for that. Sub-lieutenant, I can't remember.
It's all right. We'll look it up somewhere else. So, what was he like? What was his job on the ship?
I can't remember what he did this. I was on Foxley at one time. I was on Foxley officer at one time. But I can't remember. He used to do all the work in the ship's office with me in harbour, you know? You know, doing the various signals we got and all that sort of thing. He used to do all that. He was a smashing lad. He came to us as a midshipman, actually. And then he became a subbie, of course, when he came of age. But he had the tabs, you know, when he first came on board. And he was just a very good, big, blonde lad. He was a fantastic Olympic swimmer type of guy. He swam like a fish. And I contacted him after the war.
And what about other officers? What about, who was your anti-submarine officer?
That was Lieutenant Bell Chambers.
And what was he like? How did he liaise with you? If you know,
he was an insurance bloke in City Life, and he was good to get on with. He was a good lad, and there's a good story here. When the skipper used to say, "How are you doing, Dinger?" And Bill Chambers used to answer, and he used to say, "All right, that's not you. I want to speak." That was me. It was Bill. Was Ding, you know, Ding of the Pinger. And we got called these funny names, you know, we got them called by that. And he used to say, how's you doing there, Dinger, you know, for Bell, or Pinger, for Elsie. But that's the way we used to work. But
any other officers, navigating officers?
He was replaced by a master as a navigating officer towards the end, you know, later on in the voyage. In the ship's life, he was replaced by Marsh.
So Marsh became the
as the officer later towards the end.
Any other officers you recall?
Yes, Lieutenant Stonier was our
Lieutenant
Stonier. G.H. Stonier was our engineer officer.
What was he like?
He didn't have much to do with him being an engineer. Didn't have much to do with him, but he was quite a good man. He had his engineer's tabs, you know, the morph, you know. Many stripes. But he was good. He lived on a lot with Marsh. Marsh and he were great friends. And then there's another officer, Sub-Lieutenant Whale.
Whale.
W-H-A-L-E. Yes. He was RNR.
What was his job and what was he like?
I don't know. Well, we don't really know what they did on the ship, you know. I mean, I was in the ship's office most of the time, you know. With Marsh. I used to work with Marsh. But Sub-Lieutenant Will was really on some part of the ship. You know, he was responsible for some part of the ship. I can't remember exactly what.
And what about the senior lower deck, you know, the petty officers, leading officers? Any come to mind?
Yes. There was a petty officer, Bull, B-U-L-L. He was the regulating officer. And
what did they do, regulating officers?
They were responsible for allocating the duties of the ship and the watches of the ship. They were responsible for doing that. It was a responsible job, that. He had it all taped. He was very good. I remember him when we went ashore. We had some matches arranged, you know, rugby. He's a great rugby man. And he wrote me in for rugby. I never forgot. I kept out his way after that. I was far too little for doing rugby. But he was quite a nice guy.
And what was the other petty officers? What were their jobs?
No, that's you know, I can't remember. Because they had their own mess, you know. And, They were aloof from us, really. Petty officers. I can't remember a single one of them. Can't remember the petty officers. I'm sorry.
And leading seamen, any of them come to mind?
Well, the leading seaman that we had was a chap called Freeman. And he was good. And when the Olympics had broke down, it was his job to get going again, you know. And he was in HSD. And he used to go and attend to it, you know. He was quite good at electrics, you know. And we had in the group, you see, we had an electric officer. You see, you had a group of officers. Your group had certain officers were allocated to them on one of the ships, you know. And one of them was a chap called Marshall, who was a South African. And he was an electric officer. He had the green in next to his stripes. He was a fascinating chap as well. A chap called Marshall, he was. But then he was a lieutenant Marshall. He used to come about with the electrical troubles, you know, he used to come and talk about. He was very good. And I think one of the group ships had a doctor as well. See, a doctor would be allocated to the rest of the room, you know. But he was, I can't remember the ship's doctor, can't remember at all. And of course, if you were at sea, you know, and you had to have a doctor, you kind of sick birth artificer, you know, and if he was in trouble, you had to get the doctor, of course, the doctor had to go over by Beecher's boy, if you were able to do it, of course, but if not, artificer had to get on and do it himself, whatever it was. If there's any sickness, you had to. One time, I think, I remember that one of our lads had to have an operation, you know, and the sick birth artificer did it. We called him Amateur Joe, sick birth artificer, and he did the operation. He actually did the appendicitis, guided by the doctor on the phone, you know, on the phone.
The radio.
The internal phone, that's right, internal radio, and he did the operation like that, yes. Oh yes, and he survived, told us, he's okay, he survived, he was very good.
And any other particular personnel you remember?
Well, I remember a lot of the footballers actually, because we had a ship's team, you know, and we had some good lads there, you know. There was one of the lads there, was a lad called Payne, P-A-Y-N-E, and he played for Liverpool, you know. Waka Payne, they called him, and I used to play with these lads, and eventually I got, when we were in Harbour, I went up to Greenock and played for Morton sometimes, you know, as a guest, you know. You were allowed to guest in the wartime, you know, you could play for big teams as a guest. Well, I played in local football here, and now I reckon I was pretty good, so I got games for, Clonard Argyll one time, and I played for Linfield Island, you know, and, you know, I just played the odd game, you know. And I'm being modest. I just played the odd game. I played for Plymouth, and then I played for Linfield Island, and I played for Morton in Scotland, so I just played for Wales. And I would have played for Wales if I hadn't been here down the invasion. We were coming from the barracks then, you know, we were going to the Wales.
Well, that's probably the next thing, actually, is when they moved down for into the Channel.
Yes, yes. We went to Milford Haven. Yes, we went to Milford Haven. And we knew there was something on there for that. And I'll tell you what our job was. We went to Cherbourg. We were patrolling off Cherbourg. And our job was to get the U-boats in harbour. You know, to keep them in the harbour, not let them get to sea, in case they attacked the invasion forces, you know. So that was our job, was to keep them, you know, where we wanted them, you know. And we did that.
Did you have any contacts with submarines during those sweeps?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. And, of course, you know, the trouble was that the group leader of the escorts always wanted the glory for himself. And if you got certain contacts, he took over from you. you didn't get the glory at all. But we resented that a bit, you know, because I got several contacts in the time of my Navy career. But he always had to hand them over, you see.
And that which that that was a Duckworth?
Duckworth, yeah.
Was that real that they took over?
Yes, it was. Because they were seeing it obviously, you see, so he said, I'll see to this, you know, I'll see to this, you know. And that was a bit infuriating, you know.
And they did they do that all the time?
Not all the time, no, no, no. When they got a contact that they thought would produce results they were thinking, you know, that they would do that. Yes, they did. That was one part of the Navy that was very selfish, really. I don't know why, but maybe looking for gongs, you know.
Now, you're not aware of when the Black...
Offshore group.
And you were not aware of when the Blackwood was hit. That wasn't something that affected you. Anything else about that time in the Channel area?
Well, what I remember about that Channel area was that we were down off Cherbourg, patrolling off Cherbourg, and we were looking up towards the invasion forces, you know. And we were a long way away, of course. But I remember the umbrella of aircraft coming over there, you know. Fast-flying aircraft, I had a feeling, and there were 5,000 ships at that time, so the channel was absolutely full of ships and aircraft, you know, at that particular time. And I remember quite distinctly, you know, that we were on the edge of it, sort of thing, you know. We were just on the bottom edge of it.
Did you realise what was happening?
Yes, oh yes, we knew. Well, we knew that it was the fighting was fierce, you know, at that particular time. But we were concentrating on keeping the U-boat squared, that's all, you know. At least that was my job. That was our job, keeping the U-boat squared. Keeping them, not letting them out the scoreboard, you know, into the channel. Or not letting them in the Atlantic, that was the idea. So we patrolled ceaselessly.
Now, what was the routine for you as an ASDIC operator on the Donner to that time? You know, what watch system did you operate? Because it's different from the Beiter, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
So what was the watch rotor for you?
We had four ratings on the Donner, four ASDIC ratings on the Donner, five with the HSD, but he didn't do the watches. Four, that meant you were 1.5 on and 3.5 off.
1.5 watts, sorry.
1.5 hours on watch, and then you were relieved by 3.5 hours. You know, 3.5 hours later you were relieved. In that 3.5 you see, another watch took over, and you had four watches, you see. You had four watches, and it wasn't easy.
And you were on your own?
Oh, yes, yeah. You had to concentrate on what you were doing.
Was that worse than when you'd been in two, you know, two of you doing it? Was it worse to be just one of you?
Well, it's difficult to say, Peter. When there were two of you, you tended to chat, you know, but when there was one of you, you had to concentrate on what you were doing. And sometimes the officer of the watch would nip in into the cabin, you know, into the out of the wet, you know, because it was wet. He would nip in there to get dried, you know. But then that's the only time you talk to anybody or saw anybody, you see, or you're distracted. You were absolutely dedicated on the job, you know. You had to concentrate on what you were doing, because you would slip through your screen, you know, no bother at all. So you had to watch, you had to investigate every contact, you know. Everything that was, I mean...
Screen, I thought it was hearing. There was a screen as well.
Well, you had to investigate every contact through your ears, you know. Everything that you heard, you had to... If there was solar porpoises going past, you had to be sure that you knew...
So, but you mentioned it would show on your screen.
That's right.
You hadn't mentioned a screen before.
That was a recorded screen, which was an iodized roll, and the stylus went across the iodized roll.
So it wasn't a television style screen. No. It wasn't a screen at all. It was that's just what you called it.
We called it a screen in those days, but now it was a stylus that went across and marked across like that, you know, and every time there was a contact, it was heavily impressed on the roll. And that showed you the plan, that showed you the roof of the U-boat, you see. That was how it was done. And therefore you could see the roof of the U-boat that was taken. And with your hearing, you could tell by your fins whether he was coming towards you or going away from you. or whether he was going towards the bottom or coming up the surface.
What difference is in the pings? I mean, it's difficult to describe the difference between one ping and another, but what sort of thing would give you a clue?
Well, you send out a transmission sound, and if an echo came back, you had to differentiate whether it's high sound or low from the one you'd sent out. You know, the one that you sent out was certain tone, certain sound, certain pitch. Pitch is the word I'm looking for. A certain pitch, you know. And if that pitch was higher or lower, that gave you a clue to what he was doing. And therefore, that's what I mean when I talked about to the captain. I said, well, it's coming towards us, it's going away from us. He's diving, he's coming up, he's doing this, that, the other. He's turning right, he's turning left, or he's turning so and so.
How could you tell the right and left on the... Would that be... You said about coming and going, but how could you tell right and left?
Well, by your bearings. By your bearings. You see, if you turn your transmission knob round, and you transmit the sound wave, you knew where you were on right or left. Sometimes you ask the officer to say, train right. You train right and you try to pick them up. You see, if you lost them, if you lost the U-boat, you try to pick them up. Train right or train left or whatever. That was the instructions, you see. That was how you did it. And I found that fascinating because you had to find your U-boat, hadn't you? He's down dead somewhere and you had to find him. But I found that was challenging. That was very, 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 very good. I enjoyed that job. I really did.
Now, did you suffer any, not mental problems, but any stress problems? Why not, do you think?
Several of them did. Not particularly in my crew, no. We had a good crew. We remained mentally stable. Freeman was a bit funny. My HFD Freeman, he was a bit funny. He used to get imaginary ideas, you know, but he used to elaborate things, you know. But other than that, he was all right.
Well, after you'd done a stint, would you get headaches or tired, or was it tiring?
No, I never got headaches, Peter. I never got headaches or anything like that. But it was tiring. It was tiring. And you had to get your rest. And you didn't get a lot of rest, you know. You only got 3.5 off, you see.
Would you be allowed... I mean, did you have other duties to do? Or would you be allowed to go and sleep or rest?
Oh, yes. Your watch took over preference for everything. Your watch, if you're an acid rating, you know. The lads knew, you know, the timekeepers and people like that to arrange your watches knew that you had to have certain rest, and they would give you time to do that, you know.
And what would you do in a rest period?
Sleep. I'm sure that acid ratings have to sleep. They had to sleep and forget about what was going on around them. They had to sleep. That was your refreshment.
And you just in your bunk?
Yes.
And would the rest of the crew be around you? I mean, that were off duty, or would they be sleeping as well, or what?
No, they'd be, you just got oblivious to them walking about. You know, you just get concentrated and get your head down and refreshing yourself for the next job. You know, that's right.